Good afternoon, Mark David with NRAS and the College of ACEs, right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We're going to talk about the hypoxia zone and the nutrient load that may be affecting it that's coming down from the Midwest. Mark, thanks much for being with us. Why don't you broach that subject for us just a bit, and I'll remind our listeners that they can call in and join us if they'd like at 800-222-9455 or 333-9455. That's a 217 area code. So the nutrient load, is there one that comes out of the Midwest that feeds the hypoxia zone?
Yeah, let me first just say what the hypoxic zone is and then how the nutrients lead into it. Basically, nutrients or water and nutrients go down the Mississippi River and enter the Gulf of Mexico. And in the spring, that water, that fresh water, actually puts a cap over part of the Gulf of Mexico. The nutrients then cause algal growth, plant growth to occur. The algae then die and they use up the oxygen. And that leads to what we call a hypoxic zone or low oxygen. And organisms that can swim away or survive, those that can't swim away can be killed. And so that's the problem. And so it's the spring flush of fresh water and the nutrients that are in that. What we reaffirmed and what we came up with in the Science Advisory Board is that, again, it's nitrate that is the primary nutrient that causes the problem, but also that phosphorus was important. And in particular, the spring load of those nutrients, particularly the spring load of nitrate, the April, May, June nitrate that goes down the Mississippi River. The other thing we found is, where does that nitrate come from? It really comes from the tile-drained corn and soybean fields of the upper Midwest. So southwest Minnesota through Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, and into Ohio. That is really the source of the nitrate. It's also the source of a large part of the phosphorus as well. And our recommendation and what the conclusion we came to, reduce the hypoxic zone to a reasonable size, would take 45% reductions of both nitrate and phosphorus going down the river.
Well, how do you achieve that kind of reduction in the load? It seems like an awfully large reduction, and I don't know that producers would be
right.
Willing to...
Now, that does not mean a 45% reduction, say, in inputs. It means what ends up going down the river. Again, there's two sources of these nutrients. One is, of course, the agricultural fields. The other is point sources from cities, sewage effluent. We looked at the sewage effluent, particularly for nitrogen. Even if we made that zero, that would only be maybe a 10% reduction. So it really, for nitrate, it comes down to agriculture. We looked at basically, our conclusion was that it would be very hard to do it. We agree. I mean, there's no simple one step. We don't think farmers are applying too much fertilizer. A lot of people thought that the answer was, well, just add the right amount of fertilizer. Well, our conclusion is, for the most part, we are adding pretty much the right amount of fertilizer. So it's not that simple. We came up with a whole series of things. The bottom line is that corn and soybean production is fairly what we call leaky. And nitrate comes out even under the best of management because it rains in the spring often at the wrong time. And with tile drainage, we lose nitrate. So we came up with then a whole series of things that could be done, but the conclusion then is there's just no one silver bullet that's going to make this go away.
Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, you can. You can dial in at 800-222-9455, or if you're local, 217-333-9455. Those last four numbers on both stand for WILL. That's 800-222-WILL and 217-333-WILL if you'd like to join the conversation with Mark David this afternoon. You said there were some things that can be done. What
sure.
are they?
Well, clearly, in the long term, if we really wanted to reduce nutrients, our conclusion, and this has been seen in other places as well, is that we need what we would call more complex rotations, adding other crops in. Now, right now, the system is not really built for that. I mean, corn and soybeans are the ones that are the most valuable and produce the greatest value per acre. But if we were to go to more rotations that had other crops in them. And one of the ones that may come up that really would help from a nutrient perspective are the biofuel crops. A lot of the perennial grasses, things like miscanthus and switchgrass, really would help to reduce nutrient loss. But given that we're going to stay in corn and soybeans, we came up with several things. One of the problems we've identified is fall and application. You know, fertilizer, putting nitrate or anhydrous ammonia, other forms on in the fall leads to greater losses than putting it on in the spring.
Can you quantify that between southern Illinois and the northern two-thirds of Illinois? Southern Illinois generally does not put anhydrous ammonia on in the fall.
Right. But they have very low nitrate losses, but it's not because of that. It's because there's very little tile drainage. So southern Illinois, even though it's spring applied, that isn't the reason they don't – the rivers down there don't have much nitrate. The reason is there's no tile drainage down there.
We have a phone call this afternoon from Urbana on line one with us. Good afternoon to you.
Hello.
Your question for Mark David?
Yeah, I'm calling about the miscanthus. At DeGrimi Day, they said that it absorbed a lot of water, and I was wondering if we're not going to switch to that as a crop anytime soon, but if that, I don't even know if it's legal, but if you could plant that in CRP acres, just so it would absorb the water and prevent the leaching?
Well, in CRP acres, we don't lose any nitrate. I mean, CRP acres are always a sort of a perennial system, some kind of perennial grass or even trees, and so we don't really lose nutrients there.
Typically CRP is like along creeks where you'd have the or a lot of CRP is along creeks and stuff where you're having drainage.
Right, but I think his point is that no matter what you put there, it's not going to be harvested. So that your suggestion is that because it takes up so much more water that you would put it there to keep it drier?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is – if we had lots of acres of miscanthus around, whether it was along river banks or not, there's no doubt that that would reduce the – amount of water going into the rivers. How much and whether that would be meaningful or not, it's hard to say. It wouldn't do much for flood conditions. It would do more at this time of year at low flow, and it might make rivers lower.
Yeah, and I think as you took a look at the miscanthus and other types of things that would be coming along as biofuels, I assume the assumption would be that those would be on the areas that would be less productive because they're perennials, and they would maybe take the place of CRP acres and become productive for a producer.
That's one you could use them in that way, but others are thinking that maybe these would be on some of the better lands as well, because again, it gives us an alternate crop, it makes the landscape a little more variable, and because these are very efficient plants, we would add very little fertilizer, and there's no doubt that the nitrate loss would go down dramatically.
What are the other types of things that your recommendations were coming
out? Okay, well, so we talked already about fall in. The other things are basically doing things either on the field, things like cover crops in the winter, doing things with tile drainage management, water management, putting valves in tiles and shutting them at times has been talked about quite a bit. Putting wetlands at the end of tile lines is another approach. That's an off-site kind of approach. Even things like tile bioreactors, which have been studied in our ag and biological engineering department. So there's a whole range of things from trying to do some things in the field to doing things off the field with essentially doing something with the tile water. For phosphorus, we have a few other things that could be done. Phosphorus, one of the problems is the fertilizer is not often incorporated after it's put on, and incorporating into the soil helps to reduce the losses of it. And the other thing for phosphorus is that a lot of the phosphorus is lost through surface runoff, water moving over the soil and carried with it with sediment. And so then riparian buffer strips work. Now, when I talked about nitrate, riparian buffer strips would do nothing for nitrate, because if you have a tile, then that takes any buffer strip out of the equation. But for phosphorus, they can work quite well.
Mark will come back and speak with you in just about 2 minutes. As a reminder, you're listening to an Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Mark Report. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can dial in over the next 2 minutes at 1-800-222-9455 or at 217-333-9455. Both of those stand for WILL. We're here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, speaking this afternoon with Mark David with NRAS out of the College of Aces.
The Member Match Fund. Think of it as seed money to grow a larger base of support for WILL. I'm Station Manager Jay Pierce asking you to send a check to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org, and we'll use your contribution for the Member Match Fund to kick off our fall radio pledge drive with a power hour Thursday, October 16th. Give now and encourage others to follow your lead. Thanks.
Time to recap what the numbers look like from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange this afternoon as things finished up. December wheat futures, $6.90, down 37 cents. The March at 7:12, down 37. December corn futures, 5:32 and a quarter, 29 and three quarters lower today. March contract down the limit at 5:50 and a quarter, 30 lower. May down the limit at 5:62. July limit lower at 5:70 and a quarter, all down 30 cents. And December next year settled at $5.65, down 27 cents on the afternoon. November soybeans today, $11.24, down 55 cents. January at 11:39 and a quarter, 55 and a half lower. And the March at 11:53 and a quarter, down 55 and a quarter. November beans, $11.24 for next year, down 55 cents. October bean meal at $3.20.50, down 16. October bean oil at $43.60, down 2.48. The October live cattle at $102.75, finished a dollar lower. And the feeder cattle at $108.90, down 80 cents. Lean hogs at $67.47 and a half, 12 and a half cents lower, or rather higher on the afternoon.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: First National Bank and Trust Company, Clinton; Trainer Grain and Supply Company, Forest; Roach Ag Marketing, Lexington; and Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason, coming in on the end of this harvest hour, talking with Mark David this afternoon, taking your phone calls about the hypoxia zone and the nutrient load that is developing that hypoxia zone in part in the Gulf of Mexico. We have someone on line one from Champaign who's been patiently waiting. We'll ask them to join us now in our conversation. Good afternoon to you.
Thank you. I just was over in Clinton and was observing all the wetland on flatland there, and you were making comment about miscanthus and the possibility of putting miscanthus on those wet places. Some of them have been replanted to soybeans or corn. Mostly soybeans, and I'm thinking that these days switchgrass has been bred to the point that you could have it underwater for 8 days, and some of those low spots are quite predictable, and people could plant a plant like that in a low spot early in the season, and it could be flooded in spring or in fall, and it could still be productive. A little bit I don't like the idea that it, so much switchgrass has been planted to the point that it becomes a weed, but surely there are some species that can go into those low spots and be productive.
No, yeah, I would agree. I mean, we need to look, if you look at the overall landscape and say, well, are some of these spots that may periodically flood, maybe they're not the best to be in corn and soybeans, and so would a plant like switchgrass work there? I don't know about miscanthus under flooded conditions. We don't really know enough about it yet to know.
Yeah, probably not bred it enough, but some of the plant industry people have bred the switchgrass, which is sort of in the same bracket, to the point where it can be underwater for quite some time.
Yeah, so I mean, if that's the case, I mean, big thing now is we still don't have markets. I mean, the biofuel industry still has, that whole kind of scheme of using these plants like that on large acreages, we're not there yet. And so I think once we develop the way of utilizing those plants, then I think we really need to look at where is the best place to put those out there across a state like Illinois.
Sometimes sugar beet works. Sugar beet has got a high salt content, so it probably is not in those same places, but also, sugarcane. I wonder if you could breed a sugarcane that could come further north. It's much more productive in terms of carbohydrate content than, say, switchgrass.
Yeah, there's a lot of people looking at this now in our Biosciences Institute here, the Energy Biosciences Institute, looking at a range of plants. From getting back to our topic of the hypoxic zone, there's no question that these kind of perennial kinds of grasses could really help us out in reducing things like nitrate loss, because when we have a grass that's there, it's growing early in the spring. You know, this nutrient flush in early spring is the time when it's a problem. And so if we have a grass that's there and we didn't have to put fertilizer on at that point, we have a much better chance of reducing that loss.
You talked often about the market not being there just yet for this. And we know in a market economy that producers and others, landowners, do respond if they're going to be paid for these products, whether that is a marketplace or a government subsidy or whatever kind of income it might be. Were there those sorts of recommendations that came through?
Oh, sure. And that's a very good point. I mean, basically, that all the kinds of things, for the most part, that we're talking about that would help to reduce nutrient loads, we don't have it. There's the subsidy system, the system of conservation payments, a lot of the things. We've never really focused our government programs at really reducing nutrients. And really, we know that we can't just spread it out. We're doing things in Montana on agricultural fields is not going to improve the hypoxic zone. It really has to be targeted. If we want to reduce nitrate, to the tile-drained upper Midwest and other parts of the country, other parts of the Mississippi River Basin, which is a huge basin, and it drains over 40% of the United States, aren't going to matter. For example, the Missouri River is relatively unimportant. If there was no Missouri flow, no nitrate in the Missouri at all, if we could make it zero, it would have no impact.
2 minutes left in the program. Are there other dead zones around the world?
Yeah, there was just a paper in Science, the journal Science, just a month ago. There's over 400 now documented in the world. And this is basically where you have people and you have agriculture. We're finding dead zones because we're not the only place that nutrients, Mississippi is not the only place that nutrients go down the river. And so the authors of that paper said this is one of the major threats to the marine fisheries world that there is, that this growth of hypoxic zones around the world. And so as agricultural fertilizer use, it's not really increasing in the United States, but it is throughout the world. This is thought to get going to be worse and worse.
And finally, do you have a number on how much of a threat economically or how much of a problem economically it's causing for marine fisheries and those sorts of things at this point?
Yeah, that's a really hard one to document. Probably the place it's best documented is the Chesapeake Bay off the East Coast. It's really hard to document that in the Gulf of Mexico. And a lot of us think that that's probably one of